You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this amazing episode of our show, and I have a very special guest. He knows that I call him Mike. He's my guitar guru because he knows more about guitars than anybody I know. He's a wizard of a player, and he just is an encyclopedia on music in general. Please welcome Alan Clark. How are you, Alan?
Hey, guys.
Good to see you, dude.
See you, brother. It's been a little bit.
Been a long time. I love that you're wearing the Soldano shirt because you got me into that Soldano pedal. It's one of my favorite guitar pedals, and it's one of my favorite guitar amps. Of course, Eddie Van Halen made it famous, but I love that you're rocking that because that is a great amp.
Mike Soldano is one of the nicest guys I've ever met. I will support him till the end of the earth.
So you know what's really exciting for me to interview, because to interview you is a thrill because you have so much musical knowledge. So I've been thinking about how to curate this, and we're going to start from the very beginning. And I love that you put this in your bio. You saw Ray Charles and Kermit the Frog play a duet on the Muppets or whatever show it was.
I think it was Sesame Street, actually. Sesame Street.
Okay, all right. And you fell in love with music. Tell me what that experience was like, and tell me what made you fall in love with music because of it.
I don't really remember it all that clearly. I was probably like only 3 or 4 years old, but there was something really, really cool about Ray Charles singing with a Muppet, singing with Kermit the Frog that just caught hold of me. You know, I mean, I learned from a very young age. Little background here. I'm partially blind. So my connection to Ray Charles comes from that, really. And so I realized that this blind guy was singing with, you know, obviously as a 3-year-old, a true hero in Kermit the Frog. And I just thought it made me realize that anything was possible and music was an avenue to do that. So,
well, you know, it's funny. I don't think I've ever told you this, but some of my closest friends and family know that to me, I haven't made it in music unless I'm playing music with a Muppet of some sort, because that to me has always been the dream. So it's so funny that you resonated with that Ray Charles Kermit the Frog duet, because I get it. There's something about like that being the first image of you falling in love with music that makes sense. And Ray Charles, you know, he's one of the baddest of the bad. I know you've gotten way more into his music as a result just of knowing that he was like the godfather of so many styles and sounds. He pioneered like 60s, you know, kind of soul music, I think.
Well, Ray Charles, the moniker of a genius is probably most befitting people like him and Stevie Wonder and Prince and others. It's just like somebody who can do so much. Even though they may have some limitations, they overcome that and they just create. And, right. You know, that's what an artist should do, is create with whatever they have available to them. And if they have to, you know, step out of a comfort zone that some people might try to pigeonhole them into, it's just absolutely inspiring to someone like me, especially.
I love that. And, you know, I don't know if I've ever told you this too. When I was 11 years old, I got to sing at the Grammy Awards, and I was in sixth grade, and Ray Charles is one of the performers. And I remember this so clearly because I remember thinking this was the coolest experience. And he was playing, and as he was playing, he was stomping his foot on the floor, all right? Mm-hmm. And the backstage area for where we were was underneath the stage. So when he was stomping his foot, I was watching it on TV, but I was seeing the floorboards like right over me, kind of like every time he hit his foot, you could see like a little bit of dust coming out. I was like, this is so cool, because I was watching him on TV and then hearing him stomp above like the floor above us. So it was I never forgot that experience. It was like such a sensory memory experience, but also I didn't realize how much of a badass Ray Charles was until way later. But having that experience.
Did you know he learned how to play saxophone?
What? Really?
Oh yeah. There's live concert footage of him playing saxophone.
He was a genius. Amazing. And he's a pioneer. And you know what's so funny about you loving that duet? I would have thought that as a kid you would have gravitated towards piano, but tell me what made you gravitate towards guitar.
Well, what put me towards guitar was probably living in a household with three older sisters, and they were 5 to 9 years older than I was. So the house during the day when, you know, the parents were at work was filled with music that I probably wouldn't have listened to being a 4, 5, 6 year old kid.
That's awesome.
My older sisters are playing, you know, stuff like Creedence and the Eagles and Bob Seger and the Doors and the Grateful Dead. And
wow,
just the sound of the guitar really caught my ear, especially when I heard Boston's debut album.
Wow.
The greatest debut album of all time. I don't care who's going to argue with me on that. The thing sold over 17 million copies, and it was basically a basement tape.
Wow. And you know what? They're like layered with harmonies, guitar harmonies, cool guitar solos. I mean, they were just like, they had it all. They were kind of like I would say the American equivalent to Queen in some ways. You know what I mean?
In a way, I would absolutely agree with that. But you have to remember that first album was pretty much only three guys.
Wow.
Tom Scholz played just about every instrument on that except for the drums. And then Brad Delp sung every single vocal and vocal harmony on most of that record. And so what you're talking about is an album that is essentially back in the 1970s recorded like we would do stuff today with digital technology and copy and pasting, except he's sitting there, but Tom Scholz is sitting there in his home studio taking it an inch at a time on a multi-track reel-to-reel, piecing the song together one instrument, one part at a time.
That's crazy.
It's incredible. And to think that, you know, I mean, the guy was a MIT graduate. He was working at Polaroid as an engineer in Massachusetts, and he's sitting there in his house in Waltham, Massachusetts, late at night, just jigsaw puzzling an album together that, you know, that first song, Foreplay Long Time, had been something he'd been working on since the late 1960s. And to put it together into essentially a masterpiece. And again, doing it layer by layer, brick by brick, inch by inch, and doing it primarily just him, a guy playing drums, and Brad Delp singing. I don't know how many vocal layers there are on, you know, songs like More Than a Feeling or, you know, Hitch a Ride or, you know, Long Time. It's a ridiculous amount of work, and it's, again, one of the greatest albums you will ever hear. Perfect from start to finish.
I agree. With
every single track on it being a banger, too.
And you know what? That was like, I would say, what was that, 76? Right around then, right?
It was 76, 77 time period.
So, like to have that music doing what it was doing was kind of groundbreaking.
Oh God, yeah!
It was very arrangement heavy, very songwriter heavy too. Like Boston doesn't get a lot of credit for just the skill of the craft of songwriting, but their songwriting, their songs, their hooks, vocals.
I have a theory why too. You see, Brad Delp, in my opinion, is one of the greatest vocalists of all time. In my personal opinion, I'd put him in the same category as Steve Perry and, absolutely, you know, Freddie Mercury and others.
Absolutely.
But he doesn't get mentioned as often when people ask the question, who is one of the greatest rock vocalists of all time? Because if you think about it, between 1975 and 1991, Boston only really released three albums.
Right.
They released, you know, the original Boston album, Don't Look Back, and then Third Stage. That's really all the material you get in the Boston universe with Brad Delp singing vocals on it. That's maybe 25 to 30 songs total. Meanwhile, you got artists like Queen and Journey and, you know, Foreigner and you name it, right? Paul Rodgers and Free or Bad Company, Judas Priest with Rob Halford, you know, the guys in Iron Maiden and whatever band you want to think of. You've got dozens and dozens and dozens of songs to listen to and pick from so they stay more relevant and fresh in your mind. But with Boston and Brad Delp specifically, you got to go back to 1991,
right,
or previous to that, and so it's easy for somebody to slip out of the out of your mind. But if you mention to somebody, well, what about Brad Delp? You'll almost always see a light bulb bing go off over their head. Go, oh heck yeah, yeah, Brad Delp. Oh, listen to Hitch a Ride. Listen to Smokin'.
Yeah, I mean, you also hear like I could put 20 vocalists together and have them sing harmonies, and I feel like a signature voice you can tell right away within a, even a group of harmonies, and he's got one of those voices. You hear his voice and it's like it's a signature. It just has so much, you know, style, and it's got just grit, and it's got just amazing power. You know, he's got one of those powerhouse vocals,
and he's got a note that he loves to go to too. If you listen to it, there are those notes where he's really hitting a higher register note. And then just for giggles, he'll take it a whole step higher, and he'll pop up there. And I've watched reaction channels on YouTube watching like opera singers and stuff like that, listening to Brad Delp, and they'll go, I can't believe he went higher.
Well, that's the thing. He's got like this mixed falsetto and head tone that's just like, what? It's a beast. You know, his instrument is definitely
it's special.
He knows how to manipulate it in all the right ways to make you go, whoa. But but he's understated. That's also what's great about him.
And let's not forget to say rest in peace, because sadly, you know, tragedy struck on that one. So
you know, a lot of people don't know how vast your knowledge is of guitars, but you've been in music retail for a long time, and a lot of people don't know that you're my guitar guy. I always tell people that you're always one guitar ahead of me to kind of like educate me on what piece of gear that I'm going to need. And you told me about the Silver Sky, and I was like, yeah, I'm not sure that's going to be, I played it once. It was okay. And then he's like, you were like, you're going to come back for this guitar. And sure enough, I did come back for it and played it again and fell in love with it. But when did you start playing guitar? Because I'm so curious about when you started learning and how you kind of emerged yourself into this instrument. Because your knowledge really is the most vast of any musician and guitarist I know.
Well, here's a guilty admission of mine. My first guitar was a green tennis racket. Not even a joke. When I was like, you know, 8, 9 years old, I had asked my parents, you know, I was in elementary school, probably about fifth grade. And I asked my parents to get me a guitar. You know, music lessons were signing up in the elementary school. And I was like, I want to learn how to play guitar. But because I had actually seen Buddy Rich play, they thought, no, you know, you like drums. And so they got me a drum set. And so even though I had a drum set, I was jumping off my parents' living room couch with a green tennis racket. And I ended up, you know, when I was young, we used to have these things back in the 70s and early 80s called paper routes.
Oh, yeah.
And I peddled newspapers for years and saved up money to buy my own guitar. And at that time, I had heard Van Halen.
Oh, awesome.
Van Halen.
This is where it gets good.
My really, really, really good friend, who's a little older than me, Danny Stearns, is a phenomenal guitar player, really avant-garde, atonal, microtonal guitar player. He played me Eruption.
Wow.
And much like everybody else on the planet, when you first hear Eruption, you're like, is that even physically possible? Is this person an alien? What the heck is going on?
Yep.
Well, a little while after that, I started combing through guitar player magazines, and I found, I have the magazine actually over there somewhere, but I have the very first magazine I went through. And inside of that magazine, there was an ad for a Kramer guitar, a white Kramer guitar with Eddie Van Halen holding it. It had a little Bozo sticker on the side. And I was like, I have to get me one of those.
But he played a Kramer? Is that what he played?
I had a Kramer Focus 1000 was my very first guitar. I saved up my money. I got it for like $200 back in, I don't know, 1980, 84-ish or something like that, after I'd worked my butt off flinging newspapers. And I got a Kramer. And I did what most kids probably wouldn't do. I got it home, and I immediately took the thing completely apart.
Wow, really?
Every nut, bolt, wire, clip, spring, everything came off of that guitar. And I put it back together.
What?
And then I had to pay somebody about $100 to put it back together right. But I learned a proper lesson. There is such a thing as intonation and setup. And so I learned very quickly how to restring and set up a Floyd Rose guitar.
Wow.
And that was sort of the starting point. I didn't know how to play. I never took a lesson. My friend Danny, that guitar player I mentioned, he showed me some chords. He gave me some advice, but...
Well, I got to ask, what made you take it apart, though? You were sort of disturbed by it a little bit?
No, I like to know how things work, you know? I remember, this is a don't try this at home moment, but when I was about the same age, I was taking stuff apart, and I took apart a black and white TV, and unfortunately didn't understand that you're supposed to unplug it when you do that, and I zapped myself pretty hard, melted the screwdriver I stuck into the thing, and learned not to do that again. I learned about the lessons of electricity.
It's an important one.
I was just that person. I wanted to know how things work. So yeah, I took it completely apart, and I got more into the mechanical aspect of it than I probably should have, since I didn't even know how to play a power chord at that point.
Wow.
But the first riff I ever learned was, of course, the You Really Got Me riff.
Yep.
Most people would be like, Smoke on the Water. No, it was You Really Got Me, and it was the Van Halen version of You Really Got Me. I never really perfected it, though. But that was
a cover. I mean, it was the Kinks, right? It wasn't the Kinks.
It was the Kinks, yeah.
But Van Halen made it really cool. Like, they made it modernized for the 80s a little bit, and it made it really cool.
Well, they did, but they did something else, too. And this doesn't happen all that often. I can think of a couple of examples in history where it happened, where the cover became more... The cover affected the original in the sense that after Van Halen came out with their version of You Really Got Me, you started to hear the Kinks perform it more the Van Halen way. Sort of like when Jimi Hendrix covered All Along the Watchtower, you started to hear Bob Dylan playing All Along the Watchtower a little bit more like that, you know? It's not something that happens all that often in history, but every once in a while, another artist comes along and does a song, and you're like, oh my God, that's the way I really wanted to do it in the first place, and therefore the original artist might start copying the cover.
That's cool, though. And so you started playing guitar. You said your paper route and all that. You were about 11.
I was probably 13, 14 when I got my first guitar, but I never really took it seriously until I was probably like 17 or so.
So did you buy an amp with that Kramer?
Oh Lord, what did I have? I had a first amp I ever had was a Fender Studio 85 solid state amplifier.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't go to the basic practice amp. I went to like an 85 watt 1x12 solid state combo because, you know, it said Fender on it. Fender was cool.
Yeah, and also that's a big sound for your first time playing, too.
Wow, I'm sure it drove my family crazy. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I had a little practice. I think I had a crate or something that was, mm-hmm. That's what you usually start on. But did you start a band when you were 17? Like, what got you heavy into guitar? Was it just learning songs, or were you starting to get?
I just learned licks. I just learned riffs and stuff like that. I didn't really start doing... I jammed with some guys, you know, probably right around... I was in high school. I started jamming with a couple of guys. I had a drummer and a bass player, and we just kind of improv stuff. It was all just jamming, straight jamming. No songs, no format, no preconceived notions, nobody singing. We were just, you know, these two guys were... They were they were into carpentry and they were doing some jobs at an office building or something like that. And the people who, you know, hired them were like, yeah, you can, you know, rehearse in that office over there if you want to while you're working on the rest of the building. And so we'd go over there, we'd set up a rig, you know, we'd play 5, 6, 8, 10 hours some afternoons.
That's awesome.
And just make ungodly noise. But it was fun. It was fun. And it
sounds like you were in like a prog rock, an early prog rock band. That's what it sounds like.
Well, kind of, but it was more so a lesson in listening to each other. Because when you're doing that, you know, when you're playing songs, when you have a preconceived notion of what you're going to do, you sort of create a format that basically says, okay, we're going to play this many bars, then we're going to change here, and then we're going to change there, and then we're going to have the riff, and this person's going to sing at that point, and this is the way the song is going to go. And you're like, okay, 4.5 minutes, we're done. Hey, let's go on to the next song. When you're jamming, and I'm sure a lot of this came from my my early days as being a Grateful Dead fan. I went to my first Dead show when I was like 12.
Oh my God, that's amazing. That's one of the albums I saw.
So listening to jam bands and stuff like that was very, very, very second nature to me. And so playing like that with really, again, no instruction, no lessons, just going in and playing with these two other guys who definitely were better players than I probably was at the time. But we listened to each other, and that's one thing that a lot of people make a mistake on. They don't listen to the people they're playing with. They don't keep an ear open.
Yep.
You know, you might hear a drummer hit a particular flam or a particular fill, and maybe that makes you play something a little rhythmically different. You know, possibly growing up playing drums for about 6 years or so made me a little bit more adept at listening to the rhythm parts of the song too. So my ears almost naturally go towards the rhythm section more than the flashy lead, other than Eddie Van Halen, of course.
But I mean, I think that part of listening is training you. It's training your ear when you're listening to multiple things at once and you're listening to yourself and how it fits in with other people too. Cause like,
oh God, yeah.
That's what makes great bands great, is like that.
Oh yeah.
The true art of music is listening. And it's what's funny is like, I always, you know, joke with my band because they know that like 65% of my smiles are just from the joy of us playing music together. But that other 35% is when I hear licks or parts that were missed and just give them a little look like, I heard that. And it's always like a little joke. We all smile with each other when anybody ever hears that, just like let each other know, like, I was listening and I heard that, and it's not supposed to be like that, but it's cool that you did it, you know?
Well, and you got to remember, though, that those mistakes can actually become really important. Like, yes,
absolutely.
Like Eruption, for example. Eruption's a great example of this. They didn't give Eddie too many takes on that one. He went in and he played it. He basically acknowledged almost up until the day he passed away that there's a mistake on that recording. There is a mistake, and if he played it the way he had originally wanted to play it, it would have come out a little bit differently. And he was a little bit upset because if he went on stage and he played it the way he had intended to, then people will think he was making a mistake.
Wow.
But that forced him to play the mistake over and over and over again.
That's so crazy.
Think about it. You know, these happy little accidents that cause us to have this little moment of inspiration that takes us into another direction that we weren't 100% expecting.
Well, and it's also like with tape, he probably heard it and was like, oh, it's cool, just leave it in. Which I love that about tape, because sometimes you're just gonna not want to edit it and change it because it's pretty much as good as you're gonna get it unless you redo the whole thing. And there's probably moments that he loved about it, or maybe a producer was like, no, keep it the way it is. And he was like, okay, I can make peace with it. And it reinvented itself and became the norm. You know what I mean? It's just one of those things about music that
it was also their debut album, too.
Right.
You know, it was their debut album. So what kind of pull did they really have at that point? They were just coming off of like trying to do a demo with Gene Simmons. You know, that didn't really work out for them. They had probably, I'm going to guess it was Ted Templeman and Don Landy in the recording studio saying, hey, this is the way we do things. You guys are new. Let's see what happens. And, you know, if you listen to that first album, I think one of the greatest things that Ted Templeman and Don Landy did, and I think those were the two on that album. They basically, if you listen to the record, you listen to it, you've got Eddie in one side and you've got Dave in the other side, and they just played live.
Right.
And most of that album is recorded live with very few overdubs in it. And it has this magical spatial awareness, almost like there's two vocalists harmonizing with one another, but it's Eddie instead of another singer.
And I just bought that record on vinyl because I'm like, I buy all my favorite records because a lot of my music I discovered, you know, first on vinyl and then really on CD. And now I'm going back to the records that I'm like fully in love with and buying the records so I can listen to them on vinyl. And it's like listening to them for the first time all over again. So
I can honestly tell you, too, the very first CD I ever bought was Van Halen 1.
That's awesome.
I know the very first CD I ever got, the very first album I ever got, and the very first cassette tape I ever got.
What was the first cassette tape you got?
Very first cassette tape was Journey Frontiers.
Oh, that was a great record. I had that on vinyl. My dad bought me that record on vinyl. It's one of my favorite. It's still one of my favorite records. I think it's their best record still.
Well, the very first vinyl I ever got was Journey Escape.
Oh, wow. That's another great record. Wow, Journey records. We haven't even talked about Journey in all this time that we've been friends. That's so crazy.
The very first, my two favorite Journey songs of all time are on the Escape album.
Escape is a great, great record.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Sean, he's such a badass. He's just...
Go listen to Mother Father. Okay. Go listen to Mother Father and hear the very last note in that Steve Perry sings. For decades, I thought it was a keyboard pad. Wow. I mean, for decades. And then I went back and I watched a video clip of the Live in Houston performance from, I think it's 1981. And you see Steve Perry singing the last note. And I'm like, holy crap, he sang that. That wasn't a keyboard pad. I'm talking like I only realized this like 5 years ago. And yet I bought the record when it first came out. And I thought for decades, I swear to God, I thought for decades it was something that Jonathan Cain had done on the keyboard, but it was Steve Perry singing the last part so perfectly it sounded almost synthesized.
He's one of my favorite rock singers, and like I did an industry showcase at SIR, and I was bringing my amp in, and he was talking to one of the engineers in there, and I so wanted to interrupt him, but I just like, Nah, just let him. But it was so cool. It's just like, holy shit, there's Steve Perry just like hanging at SIR. You don't see that very often. But
I met him twice. Yeah. He's such a nice guy.
And he's one of the best singers. He's one of the best rock singers. Yeah. Well, yeah. Alan, you have cultivated a really cool YouTube channel, and where you're pulling up B-sides, album tracks, and talking about them. We're going to play a little clip. Here's clip number one. We're going to play something from a YouTube channel, and then we'll talk about it in a second. Here it comes.
Hey, everybody. It's Alan, and I hope that you are doing well. Today, we want to wish happy birthday to one of the great drummers of the last 50 to 60 years, Mr. Steve Gadd, who celebrates his birthday on April 9th. We're going to listen to a song from the Steve Gadd Band, as opposed to listening to a song with him backing up other artists. We're going to listen to actually his band. We're going to listen to a song called Rat Race. Thank you. Together. Think about that. Michael Landau on guitar, Jimmy Johnson, Walt Fowler, and Kevin Hayes just really, really putting together a solid, solid groove in that sort of jazz funk vein of things. It's just really, really, really cool. Really cool, really laid back. I know I could have played songs by other artists that, you know, Steve Gadd had played for, and, you know, maybe there'd be...
What I love about this, too, is, like, first of all, you chose one of the most legendary drummers, Steve Gadd, who's played with Eric Clapton, James Taylor, Paul Simon. You probably know more people than I do. But and you chose his solo band, which I don't actually ironically know as well as I know all the people he's played with. So I love that you chose a very obscure track that he played on. So cool that he played, like, a New Orleans kind of bag with that, because I've never actually heard him do that bag, which is just a testament to how cool Steve Gadd is. And tell me, like, when it came to choosing this song and then talking about it, tell me why you chose that song.
Well, I chose that song because I love that double time shift he pulls off at the end.
Yeah.
Just so subtly done. And it just, again, it goes back to the rest of the band listening. You know, how much of that was improvised? I don't know. How much was it live in the studio? I don't know. Does it matter? Not really. It's just got a phenomenal groove to it throughout. Everything on that seems incredibly laid back. The spatial, you know, positioning of the instruments within the mix is just perfectly layered so that you have clarity and room for each musician to play against one another. And they're all given space. They're all given opportunity. And then right at the very end, Steve just kind of goes, let's double time this and see what happens.
And, you know, I'm sure you've seen him play too. He makes it look easy.
Oh, like, God.
It's so weird how he plays because it just looks like he can barely, because he's like a short guy too. It looks like he can barely kind of like sit himself up on those drums, but he just makes it look like he's just doing nothing. And there's so much pocket. It's like, the groove is incredible. I actually met him. I had an amazing hang with him outside of the Gibson Amphitheater out after Eric Clapton. And I was hoping to meet Eric Clapton and ended up having the most intense conversation with Steve Gadd about music, life, all the people he's played with. He gave me his cell phone number. He said, call me if you ever need a session, man. I was like, I've texted him, but he's never texted back. So I'm like, the guy's always busy. He's always on tour. He's like one of the most sought after drummers in the world, and he's always around the world. Like, he's so sometimes he's texting me back and been like, I'm in Brazil, or I'm like, you know, but like very seldom has he ever responded because he's always on the road and he's always,
yeah, too. He's a busy dude.
Yes, he's a busy dude. But I love that you chose this obscure track.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. My entire channel that I do on there is mostly a response to what I saw on YouTube during, you know, sort of the COVID shutdown period.
Right.
You know, much like everybody else, I spent a lot of time on YouTube and right, I found myself getting addicted to reaction channels. And when I was watching them, I kept thinking, oh man, if you like this song, you're going to love that song.
Right.
But the problem is, and what I came quickly to realize is that people were starting to use that as a source of income.
Right.
And so you started seeing all these reaction channels doing the same songs. You know, right, if they were going to do a Van Halen song, for example, they were going to do, you know, Panama Jump, Hot for Teacher. Maybe if you got lucky, they would do Mean Street. Maybe. Right. And it would drive me crazy. Every single one, I would put a comment in the comment section. I'd be like, if you like this, you should check out Sinner's Swing or Top Jimmy or, you know, Little Guitars or, you know, whatever it was. And I'd get a thumbs up or a like or a heart. And I'm like, they're not going to do it because it's not going to get them video counts. And so on my YouTube channel, there's a couple of things I stick by. Well, number one, I never say like, share, and subscribe.
Right.
I'm not doing it to make money. I don't care. I'm just there to share really cool music with people who may never hear it. And
but it's also like you're choosing songs that are not the big hits, which I
love. Absolutely.
Which I love because like you have, and the reason why I love it, Alan, too, is like I've watched a couple of your clips and it's like, you choose obscure songs by well-known musicians or songs that should be known and maybe just didn't get the marketing or whatever. And your vast knowledge of music, it's like, of course, that's why you chose these. And it's just, it's awesome. It's a testament to how much you love music and why you love music, you know?
Well, I mean, the big reason is, you know, a lot of these songs are extremely popular because they're pushed by whatever the record industry wants to push at that particular given point. It's thought of as a non-controversial 3.5 minute long song that can go between the commercials.
Right. Right.
As simple as that. Okay.
I remember you told me that. You told me that they songs got to that length because they wanted bathroom breaks, right? The DJs wanted bathroom breaks.
Well, it's a speculation of mine, but it has a element rooted in reality in the sense that I remember I was watching the Rush documentary Beyond the Lighted Stage, and they were talking to the radio program director out of a radio station in Cleveland, which is the city that kind of broke Rush in the United States. And she was talking about why she played the song Working Man as the first song off of this obscure Canadian band's self-funded demo record. And she basically said when she got a new record from wherever it came from, the first thing she would do is she would put the needle down, on the vinyl and try to find the longest song to see if it was any good. And when she came across Working Man, that was a great song. But the reason she went to the longest song on the vinyl was because her DJs needed a bathroom break.
That's so funny.
Simple as that. And, you know, back in that time period, unlike today, when you were spinning records, you were spinning records. You probably didn't have an engineer in another room spinning them for you. You were spinning the record, which means if you were only playing 4-minute long songs, you didn't have a lot of time to do other stuff. Right. And so you picked a longer song, 7, 8, 9 minutes long, so that you could go relieve yourself, use the facilities, whatever you want to call it. And that's why she chose that particular song. Well, it dawned on me, well, is that possibly the reason that a song like Stairway to Heaven or Comfortably Numb or Sultans of Swing or Hotel California was, or Freebird, were right, massively popular songs? I mean, did they get their first radio airplay because a DJ needed to use the restroom?
And you know what? That makes total sense, because those guys are usually cooped up for like 4 to 6 hours at a time, and they would need that, you know what I mean, to just like have the time.
If songs were released today,
right,
they'd never make the airwaves.
Right.
No matter how epic we think Hotel California, Stairway to Heaven, or Freebird are, and they are epic songs.
Way too long.
They would never get on the radio today, because today, to program an hour's worth of music, you can literally click and paste a whole bunch of stuff into a playlist, walk away, have a coffee, go have lunch, talk to your boss, hit, you know, flirt with somebody, and then get back into it. And maybe the only thing you have to put on the air live is the traffic report and the weather report.
Right.
Maybe breaking news, you know, but that's about it. I mean, everything else generally you can do pre-recorded, including radio ads.
Well, I want to play another. I want to play another clip from your YouTube channel.
Oh, please!
Here's clip number two.
Hey, everybody, it's Alan, and I hope that you are doing well. So today is April 6th, and that is Warren Haynes' birthday. I'm kind of ticked off because I did a really killer comprehensive video for Warren in celebration of his birthday, and the damn thing got blocked on YouTube. So I'm not giving up. Changing my mind, I'm going to do an approach, different approach. We're going to do a series of videos, and whatever gets through, gets through. This particular video features Warren playing at the Bonnaroo Festival. He released an album called Live at Bonnaroo, and he was there that weekend performing with Government Mule and the Alma Brothers, and I believe either Phil Lesh and Friends or the Dead and Company, whatever he was performing with. He was performing like 3 or 4 different groups that particular day. And he was asked, or that weekend, I should say, he was asked by the organizers if he wanted to do an acoustic thing and open the show one day. And so he agreed to do so. And it's really kind of a cool performance. If you listen to the CD, you can hear the crowd building as he's playing. And it goes from a fairly, you know, smattering of applause. It's very early in the day. And then by the end of the show, it's just a rousing, roving, you know, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of people were there. And they really, you can hear the enthusiasm for his performance. It's fantastic. I strongly urge you, if you like this song, to make sure you listen to the entire performance, because it's a great, great CD. Anyway, we're going to listen to him perform a song called Forevermore.
I can feel the gods look down, cry on forever. to see.
I'm just thinking about it, and I'm thinking, that was my stomach growling, sorry. I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking how cool it must have been to just be alone on stage with an acoustic guitar singing to this growing crowd of people. And
I love it. I love this. The stomach growling clip is definitely one of my favorites. I've seen that clip a couple times and it makes me laugh every time because you're like so in the moment. And then you're like, oh, that was my stomach growling. Sorry.
I don't really edit my videos too much.
That's what's cool about them, though. You shouldn't. And it's like, you know what's cool? It's like you don't hear a lot of really good commentary on radio shows after they play a song. And I like that you put your spin on it and your insight either on the production of the song, the performance of the song, or just like the humanity of what that song means to you. It's really cool. It's really cool. Yeah. You see, like, it's actually one of the most vulnerable points I've ever seen you at when you're talking about music. It's really cool because it's easy to like let things pass by, but like you savor these songs and then talk about them and present them in such a cool way. And I know Warren Haynes music very well, and I don't know that song. So I love that you're choosing songs that are like under the radar again.
But the thing about it is it's the whole principle of doing the channel was to basically put music out there that most people haven't heard. And a big fan of an artist might recognize it. Totally cool. That's what you want to do. Some people have responded and said, oh man, I haven't listened to that song in years. I'm going to go listen to the whole album now.
Right.
I mean, basically my format is very simple. I introduce the song in some way, shape or form. Some of the intros are 10 seconds. Some of them are a minute and a half.
Right.
I play you the song. And then whatever that song makes me think at that particular time is what I spew out. whether it be, you know, about the production of the song, whether it be about instrumentation, whether it be about whatever the lyrics made me think of. I don't know what it's going to be. It's 100% improvised, and well, I have no preconceived notion.
What's really cool about it, Alan, is you could have easily done a guitar channel, which talked about all the pickups of a 1965 Telly, or all the, you know,
I do that all day at work.
Gauges that, you know, who Warren Haynes used on whatever tour. You have this vast knowledge of guitar work, but I almost think that you would probably get a little bit bored talking about it, because you talk about it usually with customers or people or other guitarists or heavy hitters. And, you know, you come to life when you talk about these songs, and that's what's so awesome about how you present these songs. So I'm like, I get like a picture into your record collection when you show me these songs. And I'm like, dude, this guy has so much that he can talk about. And he chooses these obscure songs that are so awesome, because it's like, I have a very huge record collection, and you are showing me songs of artists that I know that I don't know. And it's that's what I love.
We kind of, I kind of touch upon almost kind of every genre, really. I mean, I've even got some hip hop stuff on here. I've got some, you know, Swedish black metal on here. But, you know, for the most part, I have my comfort zone, of course. But the reality of it is it's just whatever comes to mind at that particular point, what's going on there. And again, I just have never really been a big fan of just listening to the radio hits.
Right.
I can't do it. I get so bored. Like, there are so many popular songs that I frankly could do with never hearing again. By some of my favorite bands, by some of my favorite artists, but I'm just like, oh God, I just don't want to hear that song again.
I love
the songs. I'll hit skip on a playlist when I'm out on a jog or a hike or something like that. I don't need it. I'm good.
I'm a huge fan of B-sides, and I love, like, and I call them like track six on a record, because track six on a record is sometimes, it's not your throwaway song by any means, but it's a song that you're like, okay, you're invested in us. Whether you like this or not, here's the next song. You know what I mean? And it's like, that's what I like about the role of track six, because track one is got to be some opening theme. Track two is like, okay, we got your attention. Track three or four, there's a hit in there somewhere. Track four or five, it's another potential hit. It could be the next three hits, three, four, and five. And then track six is like, you're not putting a hit song there. You're not putting your radio-friendly song on there. You're putting...
Except,
what song?
Except for back in the day when you were doing vinyl and track six was the first track on side.
On the B-side. That's true. That's true.
That's the thing. In the world we live in today, with the world of streaming and downloads and everything like that, you can pick and choose and cultivate what you're listening to so finely that you miss out on the artistic integrity of an entire album.
Right.
And so people are releasing EPs because they don't want to wait to get new music out there, because they're afraid that they'll fall behind in, you know, the world of popular releases. And people don't listen to the entire album anymore. And yet there is a bit of a resurgence of that with the popularity of vinyl coming back out. You get people starting to listen to deeper stuff. But do they really listen to it, or do they just find the thing that they heard on the radio, plop the needle down and listen to it? Back in the day, we had to sit back and listen to the entire thing. I don't care whether it was listening to a cassette tape or vinyl or an 8-track tape. You didn't have the ability to seek and skip. You listened to the song and you listened
I also like talk to people about this. It's like kids today will never understand.
You sound like an old man when you say kids today.
But it's true. It's true. Like sitting, listening to a radio show for 30 songs to hear that one song, and then you push record on your tape player to get the version. You know what I mean? And it's like, and you always miss the first couple seconds, or there's a DJ talking on it. So it's just like, you know, there's always like this, and then it goes into the hit song. And it's like, nobody will understand how much you savored that mixtape that you were making. from so, hearing that. You know what I mean?
When I was in my early 20s, I was in a car with my sister. We were driving. She was actually driving me to work at another music store that I used to work at. And this song came on the radio. And when I hear it to this very day, I can put myself back in the passenger seat of a white Chevy Citation driving down the road past a little ski slope that was in the town between the two towns that I was going from and to. And the Atlanta Rhythm Section's song Spooky came on the radio. And I had no idea who the Atlanta Rhythm Section was at the time. And I didn't really know what that song was, but I heard the two guitar breaks in it. And I was like, holy cow, what is this? I need to know. And the dang radio station did not tell me who it was. And when I got to work, I got out of the car and I immediately went into the store and I called the radio station just to find out who sang that song and what it was. Then I went to the CD shop and I bought the dang thing because that's what we used to have to do.
I love that.
And you know the fact that a song can transport you, just if you watch the videos that you're seeing me in here, half the time my eyes are closed.
Right.
Because whatever is going on, whatever I'm listening to, it's transporting me somewhere. And that's the beautiful part of music and the arts that we love and live in, because it's not just a rhythmic sense. It's an actual visceral sense that just transports you into a time and place, talking to a person in a particular situation. In certain instances, you can even relive the smell of what you were dealing with when you first heard a song. You can just be transported into anywhere.
I love that you understand that level of passion for music. We're running out of time, but real quick, where can people find your YouTube channel? What is your YouTube handle?
It's a pretty easy lookup. It's acgc.musicradio. It's as simple as that.
Is it Alan Clark Guitar Center? Is that what made you think of that?
No. It's Alan Clark Guitar Concepts. That's what GC stands for. I know it's a little bit of chemistry there because I work for GC But the reality of it is Alan Clark Guitar Concepts, because I started a few years ago putting some guitars together based upon like dreams and nightmares that I was having. And that's a whole other level of conversation to get into. But yeah, basically I've got five or six guitars that I've built myself that just came to me in dreams or nightmares. And I had to build them. That goes back to that very first guitar that I bought when I took it completely apart and I put it back together again.
Right.
I was like, okay, now my brain is enveloped with a whole bunch of technical stuff about guitars that makes me conceptualize how to get 17 pickup selections out of a guitar with three pickups.
Well, you know what? I want people to tune into your YouTube channel because you are forever my guitar guru. You're always going to be the person that I talk to about pickups, guitars, amps, anything guitar related, because you are such a wizard and encyclopedia with all this stuff. Yeah. Check out Alan's YouTube channel, ACGC Radio, right?
ACGC.musicradio.
ACGC.musicradio. Check him out on YouTube. Watch his shows. Alan, thank you for being my guitar guru all these years. I can't thank you enough and tell you how much it means to me, because you know a lot of people don't understand how much you shaped my records, my live gigs, with the gear that you put in my hands, with the tools that you helped me shape my music with. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much, and I appreciate you so much. Yeah, and thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood.
Nikki, it's always a pleasure. Good to talk to you. We'll do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to have you back in 9-10 months. We're going to have the guitar guru back, Alan. So you're coming back whether you like it or not. Check out Alan's YouTube channel. Check out acgc.musicradio. And we'll see you guys next week. Take care. Peace and love. Be good.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.